Now, on this Invest Talk podcast, Justin Klein listens to your questions and provides unbiased answers.
Chart is definitely in a downtrend, and it's definitely not cheap enough yet.
Invest Talk. Your participation makes it unique. 888-99-CHART.
This is Invest Talk. Independent thinking, shared success. Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. This is our Monday, August 1st, 2022 edition. And as investors, we pay very close attention to the market and naturally even closer attention to certain sectors. And the one that's top of mind for most people right now is the oil sector, and the cost of oil and its consumption levels is one area that a lot of traders are looking at. And here's a little perspective. Now, this is according to YCharts, one of the data platforms that we use. But this is put out by BP, British Petroleum. World oil consumption is at the current level of about 94 million barrels per day. Now, that's up from 88.75 million barrels in 2020, just a couple of years ago. And that's an increase of 6% since then. Now, for perspective, in 1972, the last time we had an oil crisis, world consumption was only 51 million. And that just shows you the applications for the use of oil have expanded, and the number of people that are using oil, especially in developing countries, have skyrocketed as well. Even though we've had a lot of advances in efficiency of internal combustion engine cars and things like that, still oil is used in everything, not just in cars, but a lot of manufactured goods, right? Petrochemicals, etc. So in 2021, petroleum consumption here in the U.S. averaged about 20 million barrels per day, and that's about a million barrels of biofuel as well. And so you have to ask yourself, in the U.S., what are the petroleum products people consume most? Number one, gasoline, as you would probably expect. That's about 8.8 million of the 20. And kerosene, jet fuel, that's the fourth most used petroleum product here in the U.S., about 1.4 million barrels per day used just for that, 7% of total consumption. So what this shows you is that 2021 has had a higher consumption because of the economy's rebounding from COVID. And even though we're switching from to a lot of electric EVs, it just doesn't happen quickly. And it takes a lot of time. And so understanding these longer term trends and not just buying into the narrative and understanding that our energy use is slow to move. It takes a long time. And things evolve from year to year. And this is, despite the push to electric vehicles, our demand continues to go up. So I just wanted to give you some perspective there. Now, I'm Justin Klein, and I look forward to this hour with you on this podcast and hearing your finance and investment questions and give you my straight and unbiased answers. No hidden agenda, just here to give you the facts. And the fact is, we are in a new month and we need to look back in July. And what you'll see is the market had a very good month. And this is a good lesson for you. Think of all of the recession talk over the past month, and are we in a recession? And it turns out, technically, we were in a recession in the first half. July was not part of that, right? That was the first month of the third quarter. But what you can see is that when there's maximum pessimism, that's usually a pretty good, at least near-term, indication to buy. And there's that age-old adage that when things go on sale in the stock market, people get nervous and scared, as opposed to when things go on sale at the store, they get excited. And it's kind of this weird dichotomy that, you know, people use their emotions and unfortunately, they take their eye off the ball and don't focus on the facts. And keeping that plan and sticking to your plan, even though the market is going to be volatile, this is natural. This is part of the investing endeavor that we are all going through. You're going to have good stretches, good months, good weeks, bad quarters, etc. And obviously the first half was that, but the start of the third quarter was the opposite. And that often is the case when you get extreme pessimism, which we've been talking about for a little while now. But that's in the past. That's July. What does August have in store and the rest of the year? So that's what I'm here to help you with, is to help you navigate these inflationary times, but with big moves. You know, for 30 years, we were in a period where inflation didn't really move a whole lot. Occasionally went up to 4% or so, but very rarely. It was kind of in that 1 to 2.5% range for a long period of time. Now we're kind of in this gyrating range. And you've seen with at the ISM data today, you had a big drop in prices for manufacturing goods, which is a leading indicator for what CPI is going to do. So that was a big data point today that I think everybody needs to pay attention to. So I invite your calls and questions right now to our anytime line at 888-99-CHART, whether you're listening live, 4 to 5 Pacific time, or you're listening after hours. Either way, that number never changes. So let's get right to our first listener question now.
Hi, can I have your opinion on buying this stock for a long-term investment, FPI? Thank you so much.
All right, I think, let's double check here. I'm not sure if it was FPI or SPI. I think I heard FPI, and my engineer is saying FPI as well. So no, it's fine. I think we're going to go with FPI. Just for future, everyone out there, try to say the name of the company as well. That's always a good way to confirm that. But Farmland Partners is FPI, and this is a REIT, and they hold high-quality farmland, 160,000 acres in 16 states, yields about 1.6%. And the good thing about this is there's not a lot of great ways to have exposure to farmland and the value of farmland. And as we are in a more regionalized world, less globalization, less trade with countries like Ukraine, who is a huge exporter of wheat and other types of grains, the value of our farmland is going to be a nice inflation hedge and certainly going to garner higher prices, higher rents, etc. And FPI is certainly going to benefit from that. So very small company, still about $700 million market cap. It yields 1.6%, which is pretty low for a REIT, but the technicals look absolutely fine. So if I'm going to give, if you want exposure to farmland, this is not a bad way to do it, to get a nice dividend, et cetera, and diversify your portfolio a little bit and do it liquid, because buying farmland, purchasing and selling it directly would be quite expensive. And this is a quick, easy way to gain exposure. Now we're heading into a break, and I welcome your finance and investment questions right now. No question is too simple or too complex. And if you don't have the answer, I will admit it. But chances are I'll be able to tackle your question and give you some perspective in order to make a better decision. So give me a call. This is InvestTalk at 888-99-CHART.
Why do listener questions make InvestTalk better?
Which of these would you recommend?
Because each caller presents fresh questions in their voice.
I was curious if you still think aluminum has a ways to go from here.
When do I know the right time to take profits?
Should I be looking for an exit? Should I be holding here?
And listeners instinctively realize that InvestTalk uniquely offers a welcome dose of investing satisfaction.
I think you have a terrific show, and I've learned a whole lot.
Hey guys, love your show. I've been listening for several years now, and I've learned a lot.
Justin Klein and Steve Peasley understand what investors need and want.
I would look at it from a tax perspective. If there's no tax implications, move on, find better ways to use that money.
I'm going with the odds. I think a half position now would at least get you in it and get you watching it so you won't lose track of it.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
One of the most rewarding things I do each weekday is host the Invest Talk podcast. I truly enjoy helping investors, and I know that every question counts and every answer I provide will be unbiased. You, the caller, get to chart the course for each Invest Talk podcast. Call with your questions anytime, day or night, 888-99-CHART.
Now, my focus point today is based on this question. Earnings season has begun, but is it too late to celebrate? We're going to look at the data here and what most of the S&P has said and most of the S&P has reported, especially if you look at it based on an earnings basis, earnings weighted. When the large companies report, obviously that's a bigger impact on the market versus those smaller names in general. And so most of those have reported, and we're going to unpack the numbers for you. Also, have investors capitulated yet on tech stocks? We're going to look at some of the recent flows and give you that answer. Also, the European energy crisis has shifted the narrative when it comes to the green transition. And we're going to look at how that has changed policy around the world. And then lastly, apartment rents. They're beginning to taper off after we've had pretty high growth in that space. That's also been pushing up inflationary figures. Because remember, the inflation, the CPI, does not include housing prices. It's called owner's equivalent rent, which is basically a survey of what owners of homes think they can rent their house for, which is, I don't know how really precise that is or how great that is, but clearly it's more about what rents are doing versus the actual underlying home price. And I want to look at those trends because not only does that hit people's pocketbooks, but also hits the CPI headline figure as well. So we're going to look at those data points today, but ultimately I want to know what is on your mind. That's most important for me. I can talk about whatever I want on today's show, but that's not nearly as important as what you want to talk about. So I encourage you to give me a call at 888-99-CHART. And let's take a look at the market today. We had the S&P down about 11 points, kind of a pause day right around the 100-day moving average, which granted, was pretty good resistance back in the March timeframe. Now, that was coming off sentiment that was not nearly as bearish as it was in the month of July, early month of July, late June. And so I think there still could be some upside in the market, but we are starting to finally enter that resistance zone. Right around the 4,100 was what I was thinking, 41 and 4,200. That's kind of the first zone where the market is going to meet some sellers. That's where the market broke down from before, right in that area in mid to late June. And oftentimes when you return there, there's a lot of people that were buying and they're back to even and they want to get out. And so that typically is what drives the short-term hesitation in the market. There's still plenty of money flowing out there. The Fed is clearly pivoted to some degree. Now, how aggressive will their pivot be? We shall see. The market is still pricing in a 50 basis point rate hike in September. So we have the whole month of August, no Fed days. We just had one. Remember, it's every 6 weeks. And right now, there's about a 75% chance of that 50 basis point hike, which would be a slowdown from the last two meetings, which are 75 basis points each, and got the Fed around where neutral is when it comes to policy, at levels that aren't stimulating the economy as well as not holding the economy back, at least according to their calculations. And then we have an expectation of another 25 basis point hike in the month of November. And then the final one is kind of 50-50 whether they're actually going to raise again in December. So that's kind of what we're seeing in Fed expectations for the rest of the year. There's only three more Fed meetings for the rest of the year, which is interesting. And basically saying, hey, the Fed's almost done. Two, maybe three more meetings of hikes, and then they're going to pause. And you had some economic data come out today that kind of confirmed that. It was the ISM Manufacturing Index, the PMI. So the PMI, that had the, sixth month in a row of deceleration down to 52.8. Still growing. Anything above 50 is growth on the PMIs. But what's most important was the prices paid index had the largest drop, I think, in like 12 years or something, basically since the financial crisis. And it went from 87.1 in March to 84.6 in April, and then 82.2 in May, 78.5 in June. So that was 3 months in a row where prices were already decelerating, went all the way down to 60 in the month of July. So really sharp deceleration in prices there. And that was the main thing that I think the market took away, that, hey, this is a good leading indicator to where the CPI is going, is what are the prices that are coming out of the factories. And those prices are decelerating at a rapid pace and is actually down 30%. That figure is down 30% year over year now. Now, time seems to be moving fast today, so we are heading into a break, and I'm ready for your questions. Whatever is on your mind, money and finance related, I can probably help you get some perspective, get some data for you to make better decisions. So I encourage your calls right now at 888-99-CHART.
Each day, InvestTalk listeners submit their finance and investment questions via phone or email. Would you like your question to be put near the top of the list? Just take a minute or two to leave a review and rating for InvestTalk at iTunes. And be sure to include a brief question with your iTunes review comments.
Hi, Stephen, Justin. This is Kevin calling from La Crescenta, California. Thanks again for all the knowledge and information you guys always share. I had a question regarding the dollar and commodity plays. If the U.S. dollar starts to weaken, I'm wondering which types of commodity plays might benefit the most. Would it be U.S. commodities that sell mostly to U.S., or would it be the U.S.-based commodity companies that trade internationally or send their commodities internationally, or would it be the international commodities, the companies that are based in other countries like Canada or Brazil or Europe? Just wondering how that all plays together in terms of how it affects their incomes and profits. Look forward to hearing your answer on the show. Thank you.
It's a good question and certainly a complicated one. Now, a lower dollar does tend to lift commodity prices in general, but that's typically only one side of the ledger. Stronger dollar makes it easier for us in the U.S. to buy commodities, right? It's cheaper because our dollar's stronger. But for the rest of the world, those become more expensive, especially if they have to translate them into dollars, like in the oil market, for example. But what you're speaking about in general has more to do with where the exposure to their cash flows, their customers is, whether they're getting paid in dollars or they're getting paid, especially thinking about other commodities besides oil, in some sort of local currency. And when the U.S. dollar is weaker and those other commodities or other countries' currencies are stronger, well, that's a good thing, right? Because when you translate that back into dollars, then earnings are higher. So what you're speaking about more is currency risk of the particular companies that you're speaking about, what their mix of exposures, currency exposures are. I always use a simple example. Now, this is not the commodity space, but a simple example is Philip Morris and Altria. Altria's entire cigarette business is here in the U.S. It's domestic, and obviously that's shrinking over time because less and less people are smoking here in the U.S. But they don't have the currency risk because all their customers are purchasing in dollars. They have regulatory risk, and you've seen that recently with that. But you don't really have the currency risk. Whereas Philip Morris, their entire business is foreign. So if the dollar gets weaker, that is typically good for Philip Morris and their business because now they're you know, their currency flows in the Thai baht and the Korean won and, you know, all the other currencies throughout the world suddenly are higher when they translate those back into dollars. So that's a simple way, clear-cut way to look at the currency risk there. But certainly every commodity company has a diverse set of currency risks that you have to explore and understand. But in general, the more multinational they are, the more that their business is worldwide, a weaker dollar tends to be better for their business. Whereas if it's more domestic focused, maybe it's a shale company that only produces here and sells into the US, then a stronger dollar is typically better for them. Hope that helps. Now, my focus point today is based on this question. Earnings season has begun, but is it too early to celebrate? And this is a report from Bank of America, and it looked at the second quarter earnings expectations, and they weren't really that high to start with. But on average, the 279 companies that have reported through Monday's close beat by 3%. 3%. Now, those 279 companies, while that's a slight majority of the total S&P 500, in total, they comprise 71% of the total index's earnings. So it's a pretty good representation because those larger names have reported already. Now, they noted that only 60% of consumer discretionary companies have reported so far this second quarter. And that's the one that's been under the most pressure this earnings season. And so that could change the dynamic of what percentage of the companies are actually beating. Now, bear markets typically bottom after earnings per share estimates have been cut sharply, meaning they kind of kitchen sink the earnings report. That's a term that's been around for a long time. When things are really bad, what a lot of CEOs and executives try to do is they throw in all of the write downs, all the bad news, and they throw it into one quarter because it's easier to just kind of get that out of the way and focus on the future and not have these things, potential disappointments, future disappointments hang over their head. And so we haven't really seen that so far because S&P 500 companies have revised down their second half earnings per share by only 2% since the beginning of July. And they believe a mild recession is now all but inevitable next year. And I kind of agree with that. And they're looking at different things. One is a corporate sentiment, which is at similar levels to the Great Financial Crisis. They talk about weak demand being mentioned in corporate earnings calls. That's not far off GFC levels. And layoff announcements are jumping dramatically in recent weeks as well. So there are indications that the consumer is stressed and all that. But remember, it's a mild recession. And overall earnings hasn't really gone down that much. It's basically flat year over year, which considering how difficult the comp was for the second quarter of last year, I think that's a success so far. Now we're heading into a break, so give me a call at 888-99-CHART.
Let's say you've been thinking about learning a new language. Okay, why? I mean, how would it come in handy? And where would you want to use it? Could it be that you have an upcoming international trip? Or maybe you want to connect with family members or friends from a different culture? I think you should know about Rosetta Stone. With millions of users, it's been the world's most trusted language learning program for 30 years. Rosetta Stone is available on your desktop or as an app with audio companion and the ability to download lessons offline. Rosetta Stone truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. It has a built-in, patented speech recognition engine called True Accent. So as you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you pronounce words. With Rosetta Stone, you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's an intuitive process designed for long-term retention. You really learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. Rosetta Stone is an amazing value, so your special skill set is within easy reach. You know you want to do this, so don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, InvestTalk listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off now at rosettastone.com/today.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The stock market is volatile. It's constantly changing. So how are you positioned? Is your portfolio properly balanced, or are you taking unnecessary risks? You can get guidance anytime for free if you go to investtalk.com and take the brief Riskalyze quiz.
Steve, Justin, Art from Tucson. I own Intel. Should I sell it? Should I hold it? Should I buy some more? I'm willing to hold it for the long term. Just wondering what you guys think about where it's going to go, say, over the next year or two. All right, I'll listen on the podcast. Thanks a lot for everything you do.
All right, this is Intel Corporation. I think everyone knows what Intel does. And here's the issue with Intel. They had a CEO, and that changed recently. And they had a CEO that used to be the former CFO. And history says that in the technology space, that is a bad idea. Why? Because the technology space requires constant R&D, constant innovation. And if you don't invest in those things, then you are likely to be passed by a competitor. And that's kind of what you've seen in this space. AMD has maybe not passed them, but at least on par with kind of what they do with their processors. And that's hurt their business dramatically. They made $5.50 last year, but only sales to make $2.43 this year. Earnings are down 22%. Excuse me, revenue's down 22% year over year. Earnings down 79% year over year in the second quarter. So there's a couple of potential catalysts that could turn Intel around. One is the appointment recently of a new CEO that used to be the CTO, this chief technology officer, that is a little more in tune with what's happening on the technology side and maybe getting them able to be up to speed with the future production manufacturing techniques that they've struggled with as of late. And so that would be the first bet, that their CTO can fix the problems that the CFO created over his years of lack of innovation and lack of investment. So that's number one. Number two would be the chip bill that's going through Congress right now in regards to investment in infrastructure, investment in chip foundries here in the U.S. To ameliorate supply chain issues that were highlighted with COVID crisis and all the shutdowns and what's going on with Taiwan and Taiwan Semiconductor. Obviously, we have geopolitical concerns there. And so that's going to benefit a lot of players within the space. And Intel, certainly one of them, because their manufacturing base is here in the U.S. And that's going to help them modernize, expand, get into different probably areas that maybe they're not big in right now in the chip space. So I think there's some catalyst there that could propel it higher. But those things have to line up well, especially on the technology side. If they continue to lag in their production capabilities, in their technology advancements, then they're going to continue to have margin decline and market share decline to AMD and other competitors. And so, it had pretty bad earnings and it didn't break to new lows. So technically, that's kind of a positive if you're thinking of a sentiment perspective. And it is very cheap. If they make $2.83 next year, it's trading at a mid-teen PE, which frankly,
is still a little bit expensive for something that's struggling and shrinking, right? Their business. So, you know, I'm kind of on the fence on it. I think it's kind of a hold. I wouldn't buy more, but I would need to see some advancements on the technology side and amelioration of their market share decline for me to get excited about adding more money to Intel right now. Thanks for the call. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let's pivot into tech stocks. And despite the fact that the NASDAQ is down 21% so far this year and still down 30% from its highs, bets on technology stocks continue to go up. And many individual investors are starting to double down now that you've seen big declines. And some of the most popular stocks among individual investors are these tech names. In late July, purchases of individual investors of a basket of popular tech stocks hit the highest level since 2014. So these declines are not scaring off people. They're still betting on names like Tesla and AMD and Amazon, Apple, Meta Platforms, Google, Microsoft, etc. And they're even increasing risky bets on leveraged funds tied to the NASDAQ and other tech-related ETFs. And it's a sign that investors are still in play for these wild swings in shares. And they're still tied to the narratives. And they think that these stocks have declined and, oh, they're so big or so great. They're still part of our lives. They're always going to be here. And look at Intel. Intel's a good example. We just talked about that. They can be out innovated. Things can change rapidly. And unless they have proved out a business model, these are likely to be companies that just continue to grind lower as inflation stays relatively elevated and interest rates tend to go up. So despite the fact that NASDAQ did outperform last month, that's typical of a risk on month. NASDAQ was up 12% in July. The S&P was up 9.1. So you're going to get these counter trend rallies. And that shouldn't shock you, especially with the 10-year dropping pretty decently. And in fact, I would argue that the 10-year went from 3.5 to close the month right around 2.6. So nearly a whole 1% drop in the 10-year. And the NASDAQ only outperformed by 3% in the month. That should be a giant tailwind. And it was just a decent bounce, okay? And it just shows you that the relative strength still isn't really there. And even though we had a slew of earnings from Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, etc., Apple logged its best month since August 2020, Amazon October best month since October 2009, and a lot of investors pounced on names that even had bad earnings. You know, Amazon and Apple, at least they had pretty good earnings. But companies like Meta, or Facebook, call it, that was the top buy among individual investors on the Fidelity Brokers platform last Thursday when it fell 5.2% on terrible earnings. So they're not paying attention to the fundamentals. They're just buying the names. And leveraged ETF tracking of tech has been the third and fourth most popular ETF for individual investors to buy this year. Isn't that crazy? So sentiment is far from washed out. And that's really what you should be looking for to buy these names, to get excited about the growth side of the market again, is everybody throwing the baby out with the bathwater and resetting valuations on many of these names and giving up on them. And typically, go back to 2000, which I say this is very similar to the 2000-2003 timeframe, where it took three full years for a continuous grind lower, and you had pretty good rallies, 15, 20, 25% from different lows in the NASDAQ over those three-year periods. And they were just simply counter-trend bear market rallies. And they can be nice to grab if you can capitalize on them. But valuations eventually corrected and corrected big time in vast majority of them, down 80-90%. Ultimately, the NASDAQ itself, the entire index, was down 70% peak to trough. And so I think you're going to get something similar to that once this bear market in tech finally ends. Now, Steve and I have said many times that we appreciate our diverse InvestTalk audience. And in fact, we receive caller questions from across America and around the world. So let's take a question now, this time from an InvestTalk listener in Denmark.
Hello, Steve and Justin. This is Yannick from Denmark. I have a question about a stock called ArcelorMittal, ticker symbol MG. It is very low priced now. I think it has a PE ratio of 1.4. Extremely good value, positive cash flow, etc. I was thinking this seems too good to be true. And it's a steel producer, so it's an industrial company. It should be really good in these times. I sure'd like to hear your opinion. Many thanks. Bye.
All right. This is ArcelorMittal, and this is a company out of Luxembourg. And this is a great example of how you cannot look at any data point on a stock in and of itself. You always have to look at the longer term trends and future expectations of earnings, etc. And this is the perfect example of a business that is volatile, very cyclical, and it is a price taker. Now, what they do is they make semi-finished and finished steel. They're a steel producer. $28 billion market cap. And if you look back in the history of earnings, 2015, they lost 54 cents. Then they made that climbed up to $6 in earnings in 2018. 2019, pre-pandemic, made only 30 cents. Lost 77 cents in 2020. And then guess what? 2021 made $13.50. Supposed to make $12.80 this year, but down to $5.53 next year, down 57%. So you can see these wild, wild swings in earnings over the years, and their profit margins skyrocket, and then they come back down to earth. So don't just look at the 1 year and say, oh, the P ratio is X. And oftentimes that P ratio is kind of an anomaly. Now, if you look at things like price to free cash flow, which would be a better measure of how good the company is doing, it's still pretty low, right around 3. So I would say it is relatively cheap, but based on forward-looking earnings of $5, talking about a 5 multiple, okay? And so I do think, once again, it is cheap. Is it historically cheap? Let's see. It's been slightly cheaper in the past, it looks like, based on price to free cash flow. They do have, let me look at their debt, a decent amount of debt, but not certainly not too much. You know, I'm going to give this one overall thumbs up. I'd rather them have exposure to the U.S. market, which I think there's regulation coming down the pipe for cleaner production of steel, which I'm not sure on ArcelorMittal whether they have that ability. I know there's some global regulations being passed on that front. But overall, I think it is cheap enough, but understand that it's not uber cheap. It's not this generational cheap figure, like it seems like if you're just looking at the current earnings, one, you know, P ratio right around 2. That's more of a one-time event. So cheap, but not quite as cheap as you are making out to be. Thanks for the call. Now, there's no way around it. As investors, you've got to be prepared to deal with the reality of markets. And the inescapable reality is that the investment environment has changed and will always change. And so you need to be cognizant of how political winds are affecting economic outcomes for the economy as a whole in different countries and around the world, as well as different sectors, regulation, supply constraints, you know, economic trends that highlight different different problems and opportunities within particular sectors, etc. And in these times, especially, there is more bifurcation of how different sectors are benefiting or hurting from the inflationary environment that we're now in, with deglobalization, with ESG, with demographic shifts that are causing problems in places like China, for example. And so I think it's worth taking a minute to make you aware of some of the benefits of working with myself and Steve Peasley at our company KPP Financial, based in Irvine, California. And if you need help understanding whether your portfolio is set up properly, set up to succeed in this new regime, in this new world, post-COVID, deglobalization, etc. I encourage you to reach out to myself or Steve at our website, investtalk.com, for a free portfolio review assessment via telephone or go-to meeting, or you can give our office a call at 800-557-5461. We'd love to help you in any way. Now, the sooner you contact us, the sooner we can help you get your portfolio and your strategy and your plan optimized for today's world. So let's grab another caller question now from 888-99-CHART.
Hi, this is Lily from California. I just have a question about the stock MULN, Mullen Automotive. Just kind of wanted to hear some feedback on it. It's about 80 cents right now, and it's about 60% of my portfolio. So just any thoughts or comments on it? Kind of a new stock and just a little worried about it right now. But thank you, and I appreciate your program.
All right, looking at Mullen Automotive. I haven't heard of this. I think you said it was 60% of your portfolio. That's the first problem there. Never have one company as 60% of your portfolio. Shouldn't probably get more than 10% of your portfolio on the very extreme side. So you definitely want to find ways to trim this position. Now, the good thing for you, it is up, 6% today? 9% today, excuse me. But that's up 7 cents from 80 to 87 cents per share. And the issue for this stock, let's see what they do here. Here we go. They manufacture electric vehicles and energy solutions. Oh, okay, so it's a story stock. Got it. This is a company that doesn't make any money. It's never really made any money. It's supposed to make money this year, but I highly doubt it. And this is not a company you want to own. You want to be selling this as soon as possible because they don't have any revenue. This is a complete story stock. These are the companies you definitely want to stay away from. And you absolutely, absolutely want to not make this 60% of your portfolio. So you are very, very, you should be worried. You should be very, very worried, and you should be getting out ASAP. This is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein. We have one goal here, is to help you achieve your own version of financial freedom. And our work continues after this final break. So if you're going to call, you need to do that right now at 888-99-CHART.
You are listening to Invest Talk. Every Friday on the program and the podcast, Steve Peasley shares highlights from the newest edition of the KPP Premium Newsletter. Listen Fridays to Invest Talk. And now, Steve and Justin welcome your calls and questions. 888-99-CHART.
Hi there. I have a question regarding DAFs, donor advised funds. I've worked hard all my life. I've accumulated sufficient cash for retirement, and I'd like to think about charitable contributions, and one of those brought to my attention was the DAF. I think Fidelity and Schwab Vanguard have a program to allow that, but wonder if you had any thoughts, advice, suggestions on utilizing that for charitable gifting. Thanks so much, and I'll listen for your answers.
All right, talking about donor advised funds, and yeah, there are different brokers that will support donor advised funds, and Schwab, Fidelity, couple. The positives are you get immediate write-offs. Now you have to talk to your CPA on how that would work and what makes sense. But these are ways to save on taxes now and kind of earmark the money for a particular charity later in life. And you can kind of grant money over time and from these funds. Now, the issue, or the biggest drawback, I guess, is limited investment options. So you can't just go buy any particular stock. Usually each broker has their set of funds that are available for you to invest in. And you may like those, you may not like those. But certainly a decent option if you are looking to save money now. But I would probably talk to your CPA first to see what makes sense. Is it a large amount at once? Is it, you know, a certain amount over time, et cetera? And having something like that is not a bad idea if you're trying to be a giver over the long term and you're okay with limited investment choices. Right? Now, lastly, let's talk a little bit about apartment rents. And after record increases in rents over the past year or so, growth is starting to cool off, which is going to help housing affordability and will feed into overall inflation. Now, nationally, the average apartment rent rose 9.4% in the second quarter year over year. Now, that's down from 11% increase in the previous two quarters, so fourth quarter and first quarter of this year. Now, analysts are projecting that rent growth will continue to slow in the next few months and finish the year about 6.2% higher, and expected another 4.9% increase next year. But where has rent started to fall the most, or rental market weakened the most? And it's mainly in the areas that have the fastest growing rent increases. See how these things mean revert? You always revert to the mean, revert to what the fundamentals support. Every asset class always does that. And that's why we focus so much on fundamentals here. It's because trends over short terms can be anomalous. They can be pushed for various different reasons, but ultimately it comes down to incomes, and housing prices revert to incomes over time. Same with rents, because what pays for mortgages, pays for rent, that is incomes. And so when you see the increase in prices of real estate and rents go above incomes for an extended period of time, you know that is unsustainable. And that's what happened in 04, 05, 06. That's why we were calling that here, that, you know, the housing market was a bubble back then, because we saw the underlying fundamentals. You can't have housing prices go up 20% and incomes go up 2 or 3%. And that's what was happening year after year in the early aughts. And so right now, rental prices in places like Phoenix, Las Vegas, Tampa, are all under pressure. In Phoenix, asking rents grew 10% in the second quarter compared to a year earlier, but that's down from an 18% increase in the first quarter and a 21% increase in the fourth quarter. So go from 21 all the way down to 10 in just a couple of quarters. Palm Beach, Florida, that's actually below their high point in 2021. So rents there are actually falling. And U.S. apartment vacancy is actually increased for the first time in 14 months from 3.5 to 3.7. And the total number of leased apartments increased by 72,000. That's compared to 266,000 in the second quarter of last year. And the reason why total number of leased apartments growth is going down, because rental growth has exceeded incomes. And when that happens, it's harder and harder to pay rent. And what do? You now go live with a roommate, right? Or if you're in a relationship, maybe it pushes you even more to live together into one household. And so those things are often a catalyst for that when your incomes do not keep up with rent. And that's what you're seeing now. And that's why the rental market is beginning to weaken along with the housing market. Now, I'm Justin Klein. This completes another Invest Talk program. Steve Peasley and I thank you for listening. We encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads, which you can find anytime at iTunes, Spotify, Google Play. And guess what? This week, we will break the 44 million mark. So thanks to you. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial,